The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, we hear from the head of the NIH on the grant that led to the funding of the Wuhan lab in China.
Should we just basically close up and say we're just not going to work with any country that has politics we're uncomfortable with?
They are not political issues with which we are uncomfortable. It's a totalitarian state that executes people, suppressed Hong Kong, and runs prison camps and a gulag. We'll look at the effort to control the masses.
In every single aspect of life, we are more vulnerable because of this administration, their reckless rhetoric, their reckless spending, and their reckless action.
The vice president tries a green joke out on the graduates of the Naval Academy.
You are electrical engineers who will soon help convert solar and wind energy into power, convert solar and wind energy into combat power. And just ask any Marine today, would she rather carry 20 pounds of batteries or a rolled up solar panel? And I am positive she will tell you a solar panel, and so would he.
And we'll look at the media's anger over voter ID laws.
The New York Times was claiming that the Republicans were becoming anti-democratic and authoritarian.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. The National Institute of Health gave millions of U.S. taxpayer dollars to the EcoHealth Alliance, which has a partnership with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, where many suspect the COVID-19 virus was born. It spread to the rest of the world as the Chinese government covered up and denied the outbreak. The media believed the cover-up until recently, nearly 4 million deaths later, denying that a lab leak was even possible. Many find the NIH grant suspect, as the Wuhan lab is controlled and funded by the Chinese Communist Party. Dr. Francis Collins is the director of the National Institute for Health. Earlier this week, he joined me on The Hugh Hewitt Show. I don't know why we would ever trust the Chinese Communist Party, doctor. Even if EcoHealth Alliance is made up of great American scientists, they get 90% of their money from the federal government. So it looks to an outsider like a pass-through and a cutout organization that somehow gets money to the Chinese. And I wouldn't trust a CCP scientist because they don't have freedom of science like we do in the United States. You can tell people to pound sand. They can't do that. They'll end up in a gulag in Xinjiang.
Well, Hugh, again, let me just try to argue, although I'm not sure you're convinced of it. Okay, we have had prior to SARS-CoV-2 as a terrible pandemic, two other episodes of very serious coronaviruses that emerged apparently from bats in China. We at the NIH have to think about what the next risk is going to be. Remember, thousands of people died from SARS. Do we really want to just sort of say, well, we can't investigate that because it involves China and they have some political issues that we're a bit uncomfortable with? I think that would be irresponsible. So if we had the chance to learn more about those viruses, remember, when a pandemic happens, it's not limited to any part of the world. It's global. If we have a chance to learn more about those in a fashion where we have an agreement about what research is to be done and that the results are supposed to be shared, shouldn't we be doing that? Or should we just basically close up and say we're just not going to work with any country that has politics we're uncomfortable with? I don't think that would be responsible.
Doctor, that's a kind of a shift. It's not that we have political issues with the government that we're a bit uncomfortable with. what I perhaps have a little advantage over you is I did counterintelligence at the Department of Justice. They are not political issues with which we are uncomfortable. It's a totalitarian state that executes people, suppressed Hong Kong, and runs prison camps and a gulag, and in fact, about which we have called genocide in the last 2 years. When the grant was made, that was not the case. I understand the danger. But when we combine my two issues, non-responsiveness to Kathy McMorris Rogers with the nature of a totalitarian Chinese communist regime, we have the reason for congressional oversight. Maybe we wouldn't be here with American money going to the CIV if oversight had gone effectively deep into the NIH policies and not through a cutout organization, EcoHealth Alliance. Does that make sense to you why my expertise would say, gosh, no, we're never giving money to the Chinese communist government, ever.
I'm still not convinced that you're making a case that would change our responsibility as the leading organization for pursuing biomedical research in the world, including overseeing risks of a global pandemic, the one thing that keeps us all up at night. We still had to figure out the best way, not a perfect way, to try to gain that information to prepare for what might be a troubling problem downstream. So I think we had to do what we had to do. I'm totally open to defending that and to being as transparent as possible in the appropriate place about what exactly we did fund and what we did not fund. But I think when the dust all settles, a reasonable person will say we were doing what NIH should do to try to protect the public against a terrible outbreak.
Now, that's interesting. That's a philosophical problem, doctor, because the question becomes, is there any regime that NIH would not fund directly or through a cutout organization? Would you give money to North Korea, which everybody knows is the worst actor in the world? I mean, would you give them? They've got bats in North Korea as well. Would you send them money?
Probably not. Again, I think you're demonizing the Wuhan Institute of Virology as it is pure and simple an instrument of the Chinese Communist Party. There are certainly connections there. But let's be clear. There are scientists working in that institute who are amongst the best in the world in terms of understanding virology. And many of those folks have had long-term relationships with others in other countries, including the United States, with a lot of respect, a lot of shared information. I don't think we should just basically say, well, because they're in that country, they're evil. I think you're going too far with that one.
I don't think the scientists are evil. I think the scientists are coerced. Have you had a chance to read Josh Rogan's Chaos Under Heaven yet, doctor?
No, I have not.
I would strongly recommend it. And that's just the latest of many books. I've been doing China and Russia and counterespionage for 30 years, so I know this stuff. There is not a free actor in China. There is not a scientist. Didn't someone from the virology lab get disappeared when they put the DNA code up?
We don't know that. I don't think, not the person who put the code up, who agreed as the plane door was closing to allow Eddie Holmes in Australia to post it. That was a wonderful step forward. That made it possible for us to start our vaccine preparation within 24 hours, which is now saving lots and lots of lives. So there's an example of China being willing to make information available very early that otherwise could have readily been delayed.
President Joe Biden nominated David Chapman to be the Alcohol, Firearms, Tobacco, and Explosives Director. A surprise, since Chapman is vocal about his opposition to anyone in public owning certain firearms, such as an AR-15. Many who strongly support Second Amendment rights feel an unchecked Biden administration would quickly erode those sacred rights, not just the right to bear arms, but other rights as well. Kristen Tate, columnist for The Hill, joins Salem host Kevin McCullough on AM 570, The Mission, in New York City.
Am I wrong, or do we feel way more exposed with the Biden administration than we had just, 6 months ago?
Of course we're more exposed. Of course we're more vulnerable. I mean, this could not be more different than America first. This is America last. And we are more vulnerable in a plethora of ways, some of which you just mentioned, but some of which are financial. I mean, this administration is blowing out the spending to levels never seen in modern political history. We are already seeing inflation, which hurts poor people the most. Prices are up on everything. So we are becoming more financially vulnerable. We are becoming more vulnerable with our safety as police forces around the country are being defunded We have illegals pouring across our southern border, endangering our safety, flooding our hospitals, flooding our schools. In every single aspect of life, we are more vulnerable because of this administration, their reckless rhetoric, their reckless spending, and their reckless actions. And, you know, I think a lot of people are starting to wake up to that. People who might have not liked Trump's tweets and voted for Biden because they thought he was going to be this moderate uniter, they're starting to see that, no, this is actually a radical. He's either radical or he's being controlled by the radicals in his party. But, you know, this is destroying America from the inside. It's terrifying.
Well, and so off the air yesterday, a friend came to me and said, Kev, I want to talk to you about something. Does this fit the legal definition of treason? And I hadn't thought about that. And I'm always kind of a little bit hesitant to sound too extreme or anything else. But I started thinking about, and I guess this, and I haven't let this go, but, you know, Dr. Fauci now kind of having to admit that we kind of might have, we're not really sure, possibly, we might have sent the money to the virology lab in Wuhan that was used for the research that ended up creating COVID-19. Like, and he was not just we as a nation or we as a collective of the government or anything like that. Like, his department, the National Institutes of Health, may have been the ones that wrote the checks that went to the virology lab that, you know, the Chinese say, well, no, we didn't use any of that. But now it's looking as though we might have actually been funding the very program that created COVID-19 and then got revisited upon us. And we don't seem to be bothered by it. Like, this is when you talk about destroying us from the inside out, it's easy because we are doing it to ourselves and we're doing it through our lack of paying attention.
Yep, you're exactly right. And, you know, I'm worried that by the time the vast majority of Americans realize all of this and get angry about it, it's going to be too late and the damage will be done. You know, it's hard to come back from some of this. And the left is just using this pandemic and using a doddering old man in the White House to completely reshape American government and society. And it hurts all Americans. But again, particularly the Americans who are already the most vulnerable, you know, right. low income folks with kids and families, their safety, their financial security, and their schools and their hospitals and every other aspect of their communities is becoming worse because of a lack of leadership in the White House.
To your earlier point, a bushel of corn 6 months ago cost $3.43, an entire bushel. That same bushel costs $6.86, exactly twice as much right now. 1,000 feet of lumber, $304 in 2020, over $1,500 now in 2021. It's just unreal.
Coming up, the vice president tries her hand at comedy.
You are electrical engineers who will soon help convert solar and wind energy into power. Convert solar and wind energy into combat power. And just ask any Marine today, would she rather carry 20 pounds of batteries or a rolled up solar panel? And I am positive she will tell you a solar panel, and so would he.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Vice President Kamala Harris gave the commencement to the 2021 graduates of the United States Naval Academy. Many reports highlighted one particular joke she told, which was bizarre and ill-timed. And there was much more to her speech that was concerning. Washington Examiner chief political correspondent Byron York wrote about the speech, and he joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. For your amusement, we begin with the joke from Vice President Harris.
You are electrical engineers who will soon help convert solar and wind energy into power, convert solar and wind energy into combat power. And just ask any Marine today, would she rather carry 20 pounds of batteries or a rolled up solar panel? And I am positive she will tell you a solar panel, and so would he.
So, Byron, she laughed at her own joke. Very few, if any, others did. It was a bomb with a capital B, and the damage was widespread to her rhetorical reputation. What did you make of this fiasco?
Well, I did write about this, and the reason I wrote about it was that not because her joke bombed, although it did, it was because her speech really showed a vision for the role of America's armed forces. It was very different from what we've seen in previous administrations. And I compared it to the speech given the same place at the Naval Academy by the new vice president in 2017, Mike Pence, and also by Vice President Joe Biden in 2015. And they showed much different views of what the Navy and the Marines and a larger scale, what American armed forces should do. The big headline, really, is that Vice President Harris talked about a military that deals with pandemics, hackers, and most of all, most especially, climate change. These are the modern enemies. These are our real modern enemies. And the idea that the Navy and Marines fight wars, and that the Navy are in ships on the nation's oceans, and they ensure freedom of travel on the seas, none of that stuff ever came up. And it was a speech mostly about climate change and how she, Kamala Harris, knows a number of people in the Navy because she lives at the Naval Observatory and she travels on Marine One. It was really an amazingly tone-deaf speech.
Now, you know what I would love to know is her staff writing. Now, back in the day when Peter Robinson and Peggy Noonan and Tony Dolan and all sorts of people worked for the Vice President George W. Bush, H.W. Bush and President Reagan, the writing staff would go over a speech to make sure it was appropriate. I'll bet you if we take a look at Vice President Harris's writing staff, you're not going to find anyone in the military. But that was really a reflection of bad staffing. That's, you know, no one who gives an academy speech gets an excuse. They're not hard to do. They're actually easy to do because you've got a great audience in front of you.
In 2015, when Vice President Biden gave his speech, commencement speech, at the Naval Academy, that was his big theme, was that the United States will have to place enormous numbers of naval resources in the Asia Pacific. He said 60% of U.S.'s naval forces will be stationed in the Asia Pacific by 2020. I mean, he goes through a lot of the things that the Navy and the Marines actually do. Vice President Pence talked about the sort of heroic history of the Navy and of the Marines, gave some examples. And, you know, in that stadium in Annapolis, Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium, on the upper decks, they have in huge letters the names of great battles that the Navy and the Marines have been involved in. And it kind of reminds you, you know, what the Navy and the Marines have done over the years. And she mentioned absolutely none of that, and Pence did. And it was kind of a classic military academy commencement speech, and that's certainly not what Vice President Harris delivered.
Democrats have feigned shock and horror when Republican states pass laws requiring ID to vote. Many Democratic states have the same laws, some even more strict. But the outrage apparently helps the party motivate concerned voters. In other parts of the world, the left and the right agree that voter ID is a sensible means of staving off voter fraud. John Lott wrote an article at Real Clear Investigations titled, America the Outlier. Voter photo IDs are the rule in Europe and elsewhere. He discussed his article with Salem host Larry Elder.
One of the things that Eric Holder once said, the former AG, is that photo ID, requiring photo ID, is an example of, quote, pernicious racism, end of quote.
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of hyperbole that's being thrown around. Just a couple weeks ago, the New York Times was claiming that the Republicans were becoming anti-democratic and authoritarian. One of their two main proofs for that was that the types of voter laws requiring IDs that Republicans and state legislatures were trying to push through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess my response is if requiring photo IDs is proof of an authoritarian, anti-democratic tendency, then Sweden is anti-democratic. France is anti-democratic. You know, essentially all of Europe is anti-democratic.
You point out in your article that of the 47 nations surveyed, only one does not require government-issued photo ID to vote, and that's UK. And even there, they're mandatory in Northern Ireland because of the fraud that they've experienced in the past.
No, that's exactly right. They've had to go through multiple times changing the rules, and it's different parties. In 1985, Margaret Thatcher put in ID requirements. Tony Blair in 2002 put in new rules that required tamper-proof government-issued photo IDs to be able to use. So you had both the Conservative Party and the Labor Party there taking a crack at trying to eliminate the fraud that they both believe existed. And the rules have changed over time in many different ways in Europe and around the world as they've discovered fraud that's occurring. You know, all those rules, you know, make even the most stringent rules that we have here in the United States look, you know, completely unsafe by comparison. But, you know, just to see how these things have changed over time, France used to, up until 1975, have absentee ballot rules that were fairly similar to what we have in most of the states here. But they discovered literally hundreds of thousands of dead people that were voting. They also discovered large-scale vote buying that was occurring.
Talk to me about the Texas law. That law has been described as discriminatory and racist. Your reaction?
I think it's ridiculous. I mean, look, the main things they're trying to do is make sure that somebody is around to watch the ballot box whenever people are voting. When you have the 24-hour allowing people to vote, you have people that come in at 2, 3 in the morning. Nobody's around. They're essentially saying there's certain reasonable hours that you can have it, and somebody has to be there to watch the box while it's being used for ballots to be put in. When it's not being used, it has to be locked and stored securely.
Coming up, some on the left don't want to remove their masks.
The left has lost. They've lost this. America is moving on.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. While there were exceptions, Americans, for the most part, complied with authorities when it came to wearing masks. That's not a sure thing in a true representative democracy, one founded on independence. But now the CDC has cleared the country to ease mask requirements. Some are struggling to live without them, regardless of the science. Then President Biden's Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, exasperated the situation by claiming that wearing a mask on planes is a matter of respect. Here's Salem host Mike Gallagher.
I got into an argument a couple weeks ago with somebody I like very much. All she's worried about is following the rules. You don't know what rules to follow. Whose rules? CDC rules? State of Florida's rules? OSHA? Companies? It's over. We are beating this thing. We're emerging. where the numbers have plummeted dramatically. No more mask mandates, no vaccination passport. The left has lost. They've lost this. America is moving on, and we're getting our lives back. You want to make the cruise industry treat people like second-class citizens? You know what some goofball in Florida is doing? They're going to have a concert in St. Petersburg, Florida. It's $20 if you're fully vaccinated. If you're not fully vaccinated, you're being charged $999.99. The concert's scheduled for June 26th at VFW Post 39 in St. Pete. Concertgoers who show proof of vaccination and who receive their final shot on or before June 12th will be eligible for what's being termed discounted tickets. Others will have to pay the higher price. Now, I know what the concert promoters are saying. They're saying, oh, well, you know what? It's a free market decision. If you don't want to come to the concert and you're not vaccinated, you got to pay $999. Trying to discourage people from coming who aren't vaccinated without outright banning them. It's a stunt. It's stupid. It's kind of typical of the leadership, too, of St. Pete, because St. Pete, in a red state, is kind of a blue city. St. Petersburg is, you know, run by a liberal Democrat mayor, and they're all woke in St. Pete, and there's Black Lives Matter murals on the walls and stuff. That's St. Petersburg. They're losing this argument, and it's ending. And let me ask you a question if you're not vaccinated. Let me pose this question, because there's somebody I have in mind who I love, somebody I adore, somebody who's a dear friend of mine. And I've heard that, and I don't think she'd be unwilling to talk about it. She has a health condition that is preventing her from wanting to get a vaccine. Get the COVID vaccine. Isn't that her right? Now, she's supposed to stay home in the basement for the rest of her life because she didn't get a vaccine? Or can she go live her life? Can she roll the dice? Can she take the chance of living her life? Maybe she wants to wear a mask. I don't know. But to anyone listening to me who hasn't been vaccinated, my question to you is this. Should you be forced to disclose your refusal to get a vaccine to the world? In other words, if you're not willing to get the vaccine, are you okay with not being allowed to take a cruise? If you're not willing to get a vaccine, are you okay with not being allowed to go to a concert? Senator Ted Cruz has introduced federal legislation. He introduced a bill Friday that would prohibit the federal government from enacting vaccine verification measures for the near future. Heck, even the Biden administration has indicated they don't favor vaccine passports, which is, I think, why it's going to go away. We should stop putting people with no common sense in a place of authority. Flight attendants shouldn't be cops. Cashiers and retailers shouldn't be forced to play cops. Look at what the actual police are having to go through, and then ask anyone else to face that challenge on a waitress or waiter wage. It's a great point. What do you say to the world that says to you they want you to show proof one way or the other? And to the big question, the big picture question that I have for you, is Pete Buttigieg right that getting a vaccine, wearing a mask on a plane, that's just an issue of respect? Or do you believe that the Democrats just want control?
Coming up, Rod Dreher on the frightening direction of the so-called woke.
I wanted the testimonies of people who dealt with communism, who fought communism, and who successfully resisted it, to give us advice and to give us hope that we can resist successfully this scourge that has come upon us.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Rod Dreher has written a book titled Live Not by Lies, a manual for Christian dissidents. That, much to his surprise, is becoming popular among non-believers as well. In it, Dreher seeks out those who have experienced the end result of where he believes the current woke culture is taking us, a world where government controls everything in the name of fairness. He spoke with Dennis Prager.
I agree with you. 10% sounds like an operative figure of Christians who are awake to the threat of the left. Why are 90% not?
Because it's too frightening for them, Dennis. To be honest, people want to believe that the threats they see out there from wokeness, from critical race theory, from transgenderism and the rest is a passing fad, and that they don't have to do anything about it. Just sit tight and wait, and this too shall pass. But it's not going to happen. And I was warned when I went to Central Europe, Eastern Europe, to interview for this book, people who had been dissidents under communism. They told me, you shouldn't expect that most of the Christians in our countries stood up to the communists. Everybody conformed because it was easy to conform. Keep your head down. Don't say anything. These people stood up. And it wasn't only Christians who stood up. There were Jews, there were secularists, some of whom were on the left, but they did not want to live with totalitarianism. You know, I have met so many good people here who are fighting the good fight.
That's right.
Who need encouragement that we can give them.
I spoke in Romania 2 years ago, and it's exactly what I felt. And by the way, I'd like your reaction. I said to them, and it was clear that they had not heard this often, if ever, Western Europe will not save the West. Eastern Europe will. I said that to them.
Yeah. You know, I went on Polish television today and said exactly the same thing. I'm serious. I've been over here for about 6 or 7 weeks, and they've got lots of problems over here. But they, maybe because they have the cultural memory of communism, they understand what they're facing, and they're willing to make this last stand. But I was just talking to this young man here. He's a defense correspondent for a magazine, and he said, oh, you're from America. I got to tell you how much it hurts me to see what's happened to America. America's destroying itself. We looked to America for help and for hope for so long, and now it's just unbelievable what's happening. And I told him, like, look, not all of us are down with this. We're mounting a resistance, and we need your help, too. And that's what I did with this book, Dennis. I wanted the testimonies of people who dealt with communism, who fought communism, and who successfully resisted it, to give us advice and to give us hope that we can resist successfully this scourge that has come upon us.
That's right. That's what we have to do. On my Fireside Chat, a weekly video cast that I have for PragerU, I had a pastor on who stayed open during the lockdowns in California. And you have to pinch yourself to even say those words. Your church couldn't be open. Nobody was being forced to go. But your church was not allowed to be open because of a virus? If people are not prepared to resist draconian laws over a virus, they're certainly not going to be prepared to do it if there is a KGB or a Gestapo.
No, they won't. And this is one of the big lessons that I try to tell in my book, that we have got to be prepared to suffer. This is the most important lesson I learned from interviewing dissidents, that this new totalitarianism that we're dealing with, it is based on comfort. They're not trying, like the KGB, to force us to conform by wielding terror and pain against us. Rather, they try to take away our pleasures and our access to consumer comforts and professional success and all that. If we are not prepared to suffer for the truth, including the truth of our faith, then we're not going to make it. It's as simple as that. And this, it really puts into perspective, Dennis, the way that American religion, Christianity, Judaism, all religions, has been for the past 50 years. It's been about bourgeois comfort. And that's the sort of thing that is going to get us wiped out. If we can't learn how to suffer for our faith, as these dissidents did, then we're done for.
Well, I happen to agree with you. I have been begging people, whatever their religion or no religion, to come out of the closet. But what did you say earlier? People learned under communism, just as under fascism, to lay low, let it pass. That's not the lesson, certainly not the lesson a religious person should draw. So the question arises, why specifically Christian dissidents and not just a manual for dissidents?
Well, I'm primarily known, I think, as a Christian writer. I was writing to my own people, but I've realized now that the book has become so popular among non-Christians who are also dissidents that I probably should have widened my scope. But the reason I focused on Christianity was because I wanted to talk to people who based their dissidence in God, in their faith in God. Because whether you were a believer or not, you had to believe in something transcendent. You had to believe that there was ultimate meaning in the universe, or the communists were going to crush you. And Václav Havel was a non-believer who did believe at least in universal values, and that gave him the power to resist torture and to keep up his dissidence. But most of these people I talked to, Dennis, were ordinary believers who believed that by standing in truth and being willing to suffer for the truth, that God was going to bless them in a particular way. I talked to about this one man in the book, Dr. Sylvester Krichmeri. He died about 1996, I think it was. But he was a young physician, a Catholic physician, who was thrown in prison for his faith and for working with the underground church in 1952 during the Stalinist period in Czechoslovakia. And he said that when he went into prison, he had to make a resolution there at the beginning that he was never, ever going to feel sorry for himself, that he was going to consecrate all his sufferings to God and to see himself as God's probe, and to learn what he could from his suffering there about himself and repenting himself of his own sins and learning how to love and help others who were suffering. And that is something so, so powerful. This came out of his Christian faith. He suffered for 10 years in that prison, and as soon as he got out, he began to spread the good news in his country. I know, because I've talked to these people, that their faith in God and the ultimate goodness of God, and that God would see their sacrifice and reward them for it, maybe not in this life, but at least in the next, that's what got them through.
For the entire discussion between Prager and Rod Dreher, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, disturbing effort to indoctrinate our youth.
Can we not leave the children alone?
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the look at the infatuation of younger Americans with socialism and critical race theory.
People are divided into the oppressors and the oppressed, and what makes you an oppressor or an oppressed is your pigmentation or your gender orientation.
And a great conversation on the way that scriptures, Old and New Testament, shape the nation's founding.
Maybe we need to kind of go back and rethink even some of the conservative Christian tradition and have a little less Plato and a little more Moses.
Plus, making sense of our cultural moment.
For people of yours and my generation, we've lived through a quantum leap in the way people talk about sex and gender, male and female.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The effort to create a world free of conservative values has moved beyond media, and education has now infiltrated big business. And if they can't convince you, they will move on to your children. They already have. Salem host Seth Leibson gives a few troubling examples on 960 The Patriot out of Phoenix, Arizona.
A prominent American cereal company has partnered with an LGBTQ advocacy group
to create a special cereal packaged in a box, encouraging children to choose their own pronouns. Kellogg's, the parent company of brands such as Apple Jacks and Fruit Loops, unveiled its Together with Pride campaign in partnership with the GLAAD organization last week. The campaign, which has adopted the slogan, "Boxes are for cereal, not people," will go until November of this year and rests on the premise that, quote, no matter who you are, who you love, or what your pronouns are, you're too awesome to fit into a box, close quote. For every box of Together with Pride cereal sold, it will donate $3 to GLAAD. Originally founded as the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, GLAAD promotes LGBTQ issues in the media now. If you go to the GLAAD page, and you can get all kinds of resources there on changing your child's sex. So they're into that, too. Their annual report brags of their work with Kellogg's. Are you familiar with the children's show Blue's Clues on Nickelodeon? It's a long-running preschool TV show that has been on Nickelodeon Junior since the 90s. Blue's Clues became the highest-rated show for preschoolers on American television and was critical to Nickelodeon's growth. The lyrics of its Pride Month song, which appear to be sung by a cartoon drag queen, include the following. Quote, this family has two mommies. They love each other so proudly. This family has two daddies. They love each other so proudly. These babies are non-binary. They love each other so proudly. Close quote. Why are we teaching six-year-olds non-binary as the vocabulary word of their day or year? Then, of course, we have all the coursework trying to teach children, preschoolers, and kindergartners about race. Ibram Kendi, who writes, quote, the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. He is the, close quote, he is the leading scholar the U.S. Department of Education is using to help the department enshrine critical race theory into our nation's school. As I ask, have we not agitated and tortured our children quite enough?
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, Ben Brigman, David Pouchon, Harley Eide, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Dwayne Patterson, and Adam Ramsey. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.